Chapter 6. Before setting off to meet Aunt Lucy at the station, Mr. Bagthorpe gathered his family together and gave them a thorough briefing. "Have it clear in your minds," he told them, "that our whole future as a united family depends on this visit." "Are we united?" William asked. "That is precisely the kind of unwarranted levity we can do without in the present crisis," his father told him. "We are united in the sense that we are as yet under one roof. Unless Aunt Lucy comes up with a fairly hefty contribution in the fairly near future, we shall be split up and sent to the four corners of the earth. We shall have to throw our lives upon the state." "Oh, Henry," his wife protested, "surely you are exaggerating." "Your trouble, Laura," he told her, "is that you have a congenital predisposition to look on the bright side of things. It is lucky that you have me to redress the balance. Furthermore, you will all show signs of determination and strength of character, whether or not you possess them." Jack wondered exactly how one should behave in order to be seen to possess these qualities, but did not like to ask. "As for you," Mr. Bagthorpe addressed himself to Grandma now, "you will forthwith desist from perpetually throwing spanners into the works. You will be polite and gracious to someone who is, after all, a full 10 years older than yourself, and a lady to boot. I do not require advice from you on how to conduct myself," she replied coldly. "I, of course, do not stand to benefit from behaving in a slavish and ingratiating fashion. It is fortunate, therefore, that I am possessed of naturally impeccable taste and manners." "And as for your protégé," he continued, meaning Daisy, "try to get through to her that this is not a public cemetery. Aunt Lucy, at her age, will not be entertained by a continual procession of funerals. Or cremations," he added, as a wise afterthought. "I do not propose to fetter Daisy's creative urges," she returned. "I would not want the responsibility. If I can contemplate the enactment of a funeral with equanimity, then so should this other person be able to." Mr. Bagthorpe, knowing the futility of arguing the point further, stomped out of the house, leaving his already battered family to put themselves together. No one was very clear what part they were supposed to be playing. They had been given to understand, on the one hand, that Great-Aunt Lucy's every wish was to be pandered to. On the other, they had been told to display determination and strength of character, which meant, presumably, that they were to press on with the rhubarb and beetroot aspect of things. The two policies seemed irreconcilable, unless, of course, the old lady turned out to be a devotee of a diet of unalleviated salad and stewed rhubarb. "I think we ought to have meals as usual while she's here," William told his mother, as soon as Mr. Bagthorpe had driven off. "Aunt Lucy'll never leave us anything if she has to eat all that muck." "I agree," Tess said, surprisingly. She never agreed with William about anything unless her back was truly to the wall. "Gastronomic considerations should override all others. I can easily demonstrate my own strength of character by conversing with her in French and Danish, and by playing arpeggios on my oboe." "I think we should try to strike a balance," said Mrs. Bagthorpe sensibly. "It is, after all, summer, and the season for salads." "Which don't have to be kept hot," put in Mrs. Fosdyke, who still had misgivings about the time aspect of things. "Exactly," Mrs. Bagthorpe agreed, "and do remember, everybody, that we are humoring your father. The thing will burn itself out if we give it the least chance." She sounded a good deal more like Stella Bright than she felt. She alone had seen the sheaf of stamped, addressed envelopes on her husband's desk. They had been addressed to bodies like the Milk Marketing Board, the Council for the Preservation of Rural England, and the Farmer and Stock Breeder. Mr. Bagthorpe was not in the habit of wasting stamps, even without benefit of an overdraft running, as he professed still to believe, into untold figures. It was very unfortunate that one of Rosie's hamsters was found dead immediately after Mr. Bagthorpe's departure. It was William who made this discovery. He had gone into one of the disused stables in search of a length of cable, and his eye chanced to fall on the cages in which the hamsters were kept. He looked at them, because at the time they were producing a noticeable degree of noise. Several of the hamsters were busy exercising themselves by running non-stop on their wheels. William, whose mind was currently occupied with devising methods of producing free electricity, cast a thoughtful eye upon them. "A treadmill," he murmured to himself. "A windmill generates electricity, and so could a treadmill. If we could devise a means of harnessing the energy expended by the hamsters in treading those wheels, then we—" He was halted in the threshold of a scientific breakthrough by observing a limp and furry shape at the fore of one of the cages. He advanced to investigate. His half-formed theory was nipped in the bud. Clearly, hamsters were not up to treading treadmills on any full-time regular basis. This one had obviously died of a heart attack after its exertions. "Better tell Rosie," he decided. He did so without taking due thought. He might have known, he told himself bitterly later, that Rosie would go straight to tell Daisy of this death by misadventure. Rosie truly loved Daisy and thought her sweet and funny, and used every means in her power to lure her away from Grandma's side whenever possible. The result was that Mr. Bagthorpe, later in the morning, motoring sedately up the drive with Aunt Lucy beside him, came close to a head-on collision with a funeral procession. It consisted of Daisy, wearing a trailing black crocheted shawl and felt hat of Grandma's, followed by Rosie and Grandma herself, both suitably attired in deep mourning and carrying flowers. It had been Grandma's idea to inter the hamster in the front garden rather than the back, because she had secretly hoped for the confrontation that, in fact, now took place. She was exceedingly pleased with this outcome. It established herself in the eyes of the visitor as dauntingly and possibly unbeatably eccentric, and it goaded Mr. Bagthorpe into a towering rage. Round one, Grandma thought with satisfaction, had definitely gone to her. Mr. Bagthorpe had to pull up quite sharply to avoid a situation that would have involved at least one real funeral, if not three. Jack heard the gravel scatter and approached cautiously behind the screen of laurels to observe the scene. He looked first naturally at Great Aunt Lucy, to see if she would be as he had imagined her. In fact, her face was the least noticeable thing about her, sandwiched as it was between a large beflowered hat and a chest crowded with lace and a good number of shining ornaments. These later turned out to be brooch watches, all set at different times. The most striking figure present was undoubtedly Grandma, who was wearing a black bonnet and veil that she had kept for nearly half a century, in case she ever wanted to take up beekeeping again. None of her features was even faintly discernible under this thick veil, and Jack wondered how she could see where she was going. Rosie had struck a more casual note in a black leotard and tights, but evidently thought the addition of a hat necessary to the solemnity of the occasion, and wore low over her eyes a greenish-black Homburg, presumably the property of Grandpa. The members of this procession were singing a kind of dirge, or even three separate dirges. When Mr. Bagthorpe wound down his window and started shouting, they were not deflected from their course. They appeared to give only the briefest of glances in his direction, and then made off slowly over the far lawn, presenting an eerie picture in the brilliant midday sun. Jack himself was torn between following the car to the house and attending the funeral. He decided on the latter course. A funeral was less of an everyday occurrence than the spectacle of Mr. Bagthorpe shouting. He caught up with the cortege just as it halted by what clearly was to be the final resting place of Rosie's hamster. Daisy was carrying a chocolate box. She placed it reverently under a lilac bush, and Jack guessed that it contained the corpse. She then delved under her layers of shawl and skirts, and produced a trowel. "You better sing another verse while I'm digging," she told the other mourners, and herself set to work in a businesslike way with the trowel. A hole soon materialized. "Now," said Daisy with satisfaction, "now it's the proper part. Oh, dear, poor little mouse!" "Hamster," Rosie told her, sniffing. "His name was Truffles." Daisy held aloft the chocolate box for a moment, in the manner of a magician inviting an audience to inspect a receptacle from which he is about to produce a dozen white doves. "Goodbye, Truffles," she said. Tears were already beginning to roll down her cheeks. Evidently, a long personal relationship with the deceased was not necessary in order for her to have deep feelings of bereavement. "There you go now, forever and ever, down into the soil, forever and ever." She bent and placed the box in the hole. "Ashes to ashes, dusters to dusters," she cried loudly, scattering handfuls of soil over the coffin. Jack was unable to judge the strength of Grandma's emotions behind her black curtain, but Rosie was by now sobbing in earnest. She herself moved in and threw some soil. "Goodbye, Truffles," she sobbed. "Poor dead Truffles," agreed Daisy. "Forever and ever," she added, evidently feeling that these words had a strong ecclesiastical ring.